Welcome to the 21st episode of the Frank Online Marketing Show. I'm Tamma Frank, your host. I'd like to thank IBM Canada for their sponsorship of this show. As you know, I normally interview companies that are selling online and talk about their strategies and how they're doing it. We're taking a very brief break from doing that because I've run across a couple of really interesting people writing interesting books that I'd really like to bring to your attention. One of them, the fellow I'm going to interview today, is a gentleman named Doug Stevens. He's also known as the Retail Prophet. He is the author of a new book called The Retail Revival, Reimagining Business for the New Age of Consumerism. He is a world-renowned retail thinker and advisor. His thoughts have influenced companies such as Walmart, Home Depot, Disney, WestJet, and many others. Part of what intrigued me about him and his book is that what he has to say is not just for these humongous businesses. It's equally relevant for small business. And in fact, I think part of what he's saying is that the new age of consumerism does provide opportunities for retailers of all sizes. During this episode, we'll talk a little bit about how you can identify those and exploit them. Welcome to the show, Doug.
Thanks very much, Tamma. Great to be here.
I found it kind of ironic that you've just published a hard copy book through a traditional retailer and that you even had to argue with the publisher to include the scannable QR code so that readers could see things like watch a commercial that you referred to in the text. Do you think publishing is one of those industries that's about to die?
Well, I mean, it's a brilliant question, and certainly one that I think is on everybody's minds, not the least of which people who actually work in the publishing industry. You know, classic example, really, of a business model and an industry that for decades, really, tried to refute the reality of what was happening and, kept pointing to sort of this notion that, well, you know, yes, technology is becoming pervasive, but consumers still like that feel and the smell and, you know, of a book, of a printed book. And it was sort of this state of denial. And so now, of course, it's becoming overwhelmingly apparent that consumers are consuming media across multiple devices in multiple formats. And so, yeah, the publishing industry, like everyone else now, is trying to figure out what their new business model is and how they make money at it. So, yeah, I know the irony really of, writing a book about the future of retailing and ultimately putting that in print and retailing it through traditional channels is sort of definitely ironic.
Well, and it's funny because you talk about them saying, you know, people will always want to curl up in bed with a book. And I remember my teenage daughter saying to me a few years ago, why would anyone want to curl up in bed with a book instead of a computer? A computer, you don't need to turn the lights on. You don't need to worry about turning pages.
Yeah.
She just didn't get this.
Well, and this is, it's sort of the bigger, broader question about the DNA of an industry. And in the book, I mention a fellow by the name of Stinchcomb, Arthur L. Stinchcomb, who was a sociologist in the 60s, and he had a theory that the time in which a business is founded contributes significantly to the long-term DNA of that business. So it becomes their frame of reference. And I believe that, and I think we see that all the time, whether we're talking about the publishing industry or the music industry or the entertainment industry. I really think that the time in which a business is founded or an industry is founded carries through to their thinking, regardless of the change that they see going on around them. They just cannot sort of get around that perspective, you know, that sticks with them through the decades. And I think publishing is very much like that. So their whole frame of reference is built on the idea that consumers, first of all, that we buy the product, that the consumer buys the whole product and consumes it. And once they've consumed it, that's done. That's the transaction. So the idea that, people even now are sort of saying, well, why do I have to buy the whole book?
Yeah.
Why can't I just buy the first chapter and see if I like it? And if I like it, I'll buy the second chapter and so on and so forth. until I finished the whole book. So sort of an iTunes model. That should have been something really that the publishing industry thought of a decade ago. Yeah. And yet, you know, they have this inherited view that no. A book is completed in, you know, 10 to 12 chapters, and the consumer buys all 10 to 12 chapters, and they consume it all at once, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's a really, really difficult thing, and that's why I think so many industries are vulnerable to these outsiders that come in and say, well, that's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly thought about that a long time ago. I was teaching e-commerce at the University of Alberta, and I thought, you know, textbooks are a classic case of that. How many hundreds of dollars did you spend on textbooks as a student where you really only needed one or two chapters? I mean, but that's another industry where they've been very reluctant to adopt change.
Exactly, and very reluctant to adopt change, and also very, very resistant to competition. So, you know, if you look at industries like publishing, there's tremendous barriers to entry, you know, to challenge a publisher. You needed distribution, you needed a sales force, you needed, you know, enormous infrastructure for printing and binding. And so to the idea that someone could just come along and you know, print books and challenge you was ridiculous.
Yeah.
But in a post-digital age now, that's not only entirely possible, but it's happening all the time. So, you know, there are a lot of industries like that where the barriers, even banking now, we're seeing startups come in, like Square, for example. Square Payments is coming along and saying, yeah, we can do that, and we can do it far more efficiently than, you know, payment processing companies. And Square's now doing, I think the latest estimate was something like $500 million in transactions. So, I mean,
wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty significant stuff.
You talk in the book about how, and I think this sort of flows out of what you're just saying here, the need to differentiate or dominate. Can you talk a bit more about that and how that affects businesses?
Yeah, I think the tendency in business, especially when times get tough, you know, when there's disruption and there's pressure to compete, is that we do just that. We try to compete. And we do that in a lot of cases by trying to be good at almost everything. So we say, well, you know, if I'm under pressure from online retailers or I'm under pressure from big box retailers, you know, I have to be sure as a retailer that I have a good location and that my staff are good and that my pricing is good and my, you know, my level of convenience is good. And so we become good. we will ourselves to become good, to become average. But what research shows is that the best companies are not good at everything. They're typically only dominant at one thing.
Interesting.
Yeah, so, you know, and there are only so many ways you can compete. You can compete on the basis of service, product, price, and perhaps convenience is another, you know, competitive play.
Yep.
But you've got to pick one of those, and you have to say, as a retailer, I'm going to be dominant in this. So I may not be the most convenient retailer. I may not have the best pricing. I may not even have a service proposition that appeals to everybody. But day in, day out, 365 days a year, I am going to have the highest quality product in the marketplace, period. And if you commit to that and you truly are dominant at that dimension, it's almost inevitable that you're going to gain a reputation for it. And that people are going to start talking about it. And we see it happen all the time, that a retailer brings a product to the market or a brand brings a product to the market that is so exceptional that it doesn't need much marketing. People just start spreading the word. And that can apply to any of those competitive dimensions. But you need to pick one where you're dominant. And then typically what best practice says is that you pick a second where you are differentiated. Let's say I want to be dominant with my product. My product is my dominant competency, but my service perhaps will be the area where I differentiate.
Can you clarify then what you mean, what's different between dominant versus differentiate?
Sure. I'll give you an example. Maybe that'll help to clarify. And I'll use the example that everybody's used, but I'll beat it to death. Apple stores, right? So,
right.
You know, Apple, if you think about Apple and you say, okay, well, where is Apple dominant? Is it Is it in price? Is it in service? Is it in convenience? Or is it in product? Well, you could sort of eliminate convenience right away because you could say, well, it's not really the most convenient because there isn't an Apple store in every mall. There isn't an Apple store on every corner. To get to one, you know, it requires some degree of effort.
And even once you get there, there are huge crowds all the time, so it takes forever to get service.
Yeah, sure. So it's certainly not the most convenient. You could argue that Amazon is more convenient. You could even argue perhaps that Best Buy is more convenient than Apple stores. Then you say, well, are they dominant in price? Well, no, there's a huge premium to buy Apple products. Significant premium. I can go out and buy a notebook computer for a few hundred dollars, but if I buy an Apple computer, it's significantly more than that. So yeah. It comes to be very clear that the play for Apple is that their dominance is product. Yeah. Nobody makes a computer that is precisely like an Apple computer. Nobody makes a phone that is precisely like an iPhone. There's something unique and special about their product. And it's very, very difficult for anyone to take that away from them. Now, where do they differentiate? Well, the Apple experience, the service experience, is, you could argue about whether or not it's dominant, but it's certainly different.
Right.
It's certainly different than what you're going to get at Best Buy, or if you get online and you're dealing with Dell. It is a tangibly different experience, which makes it very difficult to compare to someone else.
Right.
And that becomes a very strong competitive duo when you put those two things together.
Okay. So it seems to me then that that does offer some happy potential for smaller businesses because it should be easier for them to do this, don't you think? Or I guess the challenge they still have, though, is getting the word out, even if they are different and dominate in a particular area.
Well, and this is the thing. We are actually entering an incredibly hopeful time for small and medium-sized retailers, but really scale isn't even really the issue. It's any retailer who has a great idea, who has a great product and can bring something unique to the market. Because for the first time in probably more than 100 years, we are at a point where a small retailer with a remarkable proposition can actually scale at about the same magnitude as a lousy retailer with deep pockets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a new thing. I mean, clearly since about 1965, if you were a retailer who could go and buy a tremendous amount of advertising and mass media, particularly television, it didn't really matter what your stores were like or your products or anything else. You were going to be able to buy attention on a scale that nobody could compete with. So that has changed. So to your point, I think we really are at a rather magical time right now where the small to medium sized retailer who says, you know what, I have a phenomenal product that is truly unique, truly differentiated, and I'm able to give that to consumers in a way that is special, differentiated, and meaningful, you know, that there's a meaningful element to the experience. They don't need to go and buy tons of media because the consumer can become that media for them.
Actually, when I think back even to when I got my first iPhone, or maybe even it was an iPod altogether, just the magic of the beautiful box in which they presented it, it does make a difference, certainly in how it affects you. Now, talking about the marketing and advertising side of things, you said that engagement is the new advertising, but no, you didn't seem to mean that in a good way. Can you talk a little bit about that?
There came this point in time where it became very clear that the marginal gains on advertising were diminishing. I mean, the whole relationship between what you spent and what you got out of that spend was becoming very, very marginal at best. And so, yeah, so everybody sort of at a certain point, it seemed the marketing industry sort of acknowledged the fact that conventional advertising, as we knew it, conventional mass media was over with, and we had to move on to this idea that it was no longer a one-way conversation, but it was definitely a two-way conversation with consumers. It was about engagement. So now what I find is that if you, as a consumer, if you ask yourself after a given day, how many times was I asked to engage the brand? So how many times did somebody say, follow us on Facebook, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, participate in our contest, help us name our newest flavor, tell us what you thought of your last Air Canada flight, you know, and that sort of thing. As an industry, all we're doing is we are taking the same approach that we took for decades to mass advertising, and we're applying that to mass engagement. As a consumer, if you ask yourself, what's the payoff? So I contribute to your contest. I contribute to helping name your new flavor. I tweet about you on Twitter. What is the payoff for me doing that? And in fact, what we find is that the payoff is almost nil.
Yeah.
It's nothing. All you're asking me to do is contribute free of charge marketing.
Yeah.
And if I do that, there's nothing in it for me. So I really think that it's becoming a bit of an epidemic.
I agree.
And I think we have to really, as marketers, take a step back and say, is this really what we're talking about? When we talk about bringing someone into, you know, here, I'll give you a good example statistically, and don't quote me on these stats. I may be a point or two off. The vast minority of consumers, when surveyed, actually say that they follow a brand to be part of its community. I think it's about 22%. Mm-hmm. But when you go to executives within retail companies and brands and you say, what percentage of consumers follow you to be part of your community? The response is well over 60% of executives believe that that's the motivating factor. There's a vast disconnect between the two that, you know, in fact, what consumers want is they want either product information or they want discounts.
Yep.
They want some tangible benefit to belonging. It's not to join hands and sing kumbaya and and yet executives believe it is. So I think executives in the marketing industry need to come to the understanding very quickly that consumers are just like them. You know, consumers are not this group, this nebulous group who has different needs than the people who actually work in these marketing positions, and that people don't necessarily want to engage with your brand or join your Facebook page, but they want meaningful connection that's tangible and provides a benefit.
So then how can an organization create that desire? Like, what should they be looking for to figure out what would provide meaningful connection?
I think, and this is what I guess some folks find frustrating, but it comes back to the same thing again and again and again. Whenever you get into a conversation about, so how is the best way to engage my consumers? How is the best, you know, what is the best format, the best channel, the best strategy? The best strategy is to really have an outstanding product or service, right? But you need to first of all start there. Before you say, how am I going to, you know, how can we get consumers to care about us? You need to start with what it is you offer. And, you know, somebody said to me the other day, what advice would you give to somebody who was opening a shoe store? And I said, my first piece of advice would be that the world doesn't need another shoe store.
Yeah.
And if you internalize that and you get your head around that, then you start to say, okay, so what can I do besides just become a distribution point for shoes? Because really nobody should be expected to care about that. We're being very arrogant if we expect that just because we have a business and we provide a service or a product that anyone should really care about that. But if that product or service happens to be outstanding, it's remarkable, it's differentiated, it's unique, and it's valuable, then I won't need to beg people to like it,
yeah,
interest in it. Give you a good example. You know, a company called Warby Parker is, you talk about a startup taking on a big industry. Warby Parker is a startup brand that is now taking on the optical industry. And their business model is rather unique. You go online to warbyparker.com and you can search through virtually, and you can actually try on virtually, hundreds of different pairs of prescription eyeglass frames. Once you find some that you like, you can order 5 pairs of frames, and you can have those delivered free of charge to your home, and you can try them on.
Ah.
Then put all 5 back in the box, ship them back to Warby Parker free of charge, And you go online, you pick the ones that you want, you give them your prescription information, and a couple weeks later, you get your eyeglasses delivered to you free of charge for $95.
Wow.
And so Warby Parker has been written about, they've been tweeted about, they've been talked about on Facebook. I have talked about them on TV and radio and interviews, and I don't think they've spent a nickel in conventional advertising.
Mm-hmm.
So here's somebody that just did something that was worth taking notice of, and I really believe that that is the key thing. And a lot of companies and a lot of retailers don't want to hear that because it means hard work and creativity and, you know, means making a difference.
Yes. When I think about the role that creativity is increasingly needing to play in the retail world and the business world generally, I sort of get the feeling that really a traditional liberal arts education should start to become more important rather than less. You know, the MBAs may be a little less important.
I agree. I completely agree with you. I think that what we're seeing is that business people are moving from becoming... Well, I shouldn't say it. I won't say it absolutely. I think that there are two groups of strong people out there in the business world now. I think there are people who are extremely good with data and understanding mathematics and data and technological inputs.
Yep.
And on the other side, I think there are people who are remarkable at curating, editing, and creating. Mm-hmm. You know, and there are these two very distinct groups of people, but. Yeah, I agree with you. Creativity is essential to innovation, and it's a skill that is woefully lacking in this world because we don't reward it. We don't promote it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll talk to companies and I'll say, how important is innovation to your company? And they'll say, well, it's paramount. You know, it's a core competency. Innovation is, you know, it's what we do. And I'll say, oh, that's interesting. Now, can you tell me how your compensation plan works? And your rewards plan internally. And what I find is that while they say innovation is the paramount goal, their compensation plan actually rewards compliance.
Yeah.
Complicity. You get paid to do what you're told to do, when you're told to do it, and how you're told to do it. And yet you're expected to be creative, innovative, and disruptive. Two don't really go hand in hand. So, no, you're quite right. Creativity is not just a nice to have anymore. I think it's an essential aspect of surviving.
You talk in the book about the third self, which I think to a large extent really is about creativity, about thinking about when and where a customer would think about or need your products. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
In retailing for, the last couple thousand years, it's always been about really two shelves that marketers have had to concern themselves with. The shelf in the consumer's home where they put your product once they buy it, and the shelf in your store or your distribution where you try and convince a consumer to buy your product. And really, that's where the concerted effort, the sales effort has gone, the marketing effort has gone, and then we've sort of connected the two with mass media, right? This cloud of mass media in the middle where hopefully we could ingest consumers into the purchase funnel and somehow magically get them to buy our product. So that's been that these two shelves have been the construct. But now technology is coming along and it's saying, but there's a third shelf, and the third shelf can be wherever in the world you want it to be. And it can be in sometimes very non-obvious locations. And I think we awakened to this concept when we saw what Tesco did in the Korean subways.
Can you elaborate on that? It was a great example in the book.
Sure. So Tesco, who is kind of a European competitor to Walmart, major grocer and hard goods retailer, has operations in South Korea under the Home Plus brand. And they were always sort of, you know, kind of a number two player in that market, a very, very difficult market to capture additional market share in because real estate, very difficult to come by. And moreover, it's kind of a unique consumer set because South Koreans tend to be inordinately hard workers. They put a tremendous amount of hours in at work and they commute great distances to work. So to try and, get them through mass media is difficult because they don't have a lot of downtime to really consume mass media. So Tesco did something rather ingenious. They said, well, wait a minute, if we can't get the consumer to come to us, why don't we just take the store directly to the consumer and we'll take it to them where they spend a lot of their time. And that happened to be on subway platforms. So rather than create a store with all the infrastructure that that comes with, they created virtual stores. And they basically took photographic images, high-definition photographic images of actual store shelves, so merchandised exactly the way a real store would be merchandised. And then underneath each product, they put a QR code that once somebody had downloaded the HomePlus app, they could simply scan the QR code that would add the product to their online basket. They could do the entire transaction essentially while they were waiting for their subway train, and they could schedule delivery for later that evening.
Wow.
So, you know, and this started to circulate through the retail community, and I think everybody kind of, there was this collective gasp, like, oh my gosh, this is transformative. And it was directionally very clear that we had reached a point where technology had really disrupted this whole construct of location, of the purchase funnel, because it was no longer simply about hitting me with mass media and then dragging me to a store location where I made up my mind at the shelf. You could get me at a point along that purchase path where it made the most sense, where it was contextually relevant for me to buy my groceries. Now, since then, we've seen Tesco now roll this concept out in different iterations in places like Gatwick Airport. So, you know, as you're getting on your plane to head home, you can ask yourself the question we all ask, do I have food at home for tomorrow morning? Order that now. While you're at the airport, you can order those staples and make sure that they're at home in time for your arrival. So this raises all kinds of questions now about marketing in general and this idea of transporting not just the marketing message to a consumer, but the buying opportunity.
Yeah.
You don't just bring your ad to me, bring the store to me in a contextually relevant way and I will buy from you. You know, and that ultimately is the easiest way for me to understand your brand, your service standards, everything about you, your product, if I buy from you, not if you advertise to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's really about the consumer finding you at a time when and in a place where they're looking, where they have the need.
Exactly. That's exactly the point. I was doing a conference recently on the East Coast of Canada, and after the keynote, a lady came up and she said, I'd like your advice on something. She said, I've got a new revolutionary mosquito repellent. And it's really great. It works better than Off. It works better than Muscool. It's kind of garlic based. It's all natural. It's hypoallergenic. And she went on and on and on and sung its praises. And she said, but the problem is I'm having a really difficult time getting distribution. Had a meeting with Canadian Tire. They sort of seem interested, but, you know, no commitment. How can I get distribution of my product? And they said, you know, just a thought. Where do people typically need mosquito repellent the most? Or, you know, when are they most receptive to a message about buying this repellent? And she said, probably when they are being bitten by mosquitoes.
Yeah.
Which is the correct answer. In that moment where I'm being eaten alive by mosquitoes in the woods, there's very little I wouldn't pay to have mosquito repellent, especially if it's as good as what she was saying. So I said, look, why don't you forget about distribution? And instead, why don't you talk to campgrounds around the East Coast of Canada, of which I'm sure there are hundreds, and see if you can develop a virtual store proposition where somebody only needs to scan a barcode or scan a QR code that says, if you're being bitten by mosquitoes, scan this code now, and we'll make sure you have mosquito repellent sent to your campsite. She could get her product into the marketplace. She could get consumers talking about it, and then maybe return to Canadian Tire a year from now and say, oh, by the way, I'm selling 50,000 units a year.
Yeah.
Now are you interested? So
why would she do that, though, rather than simply supplying them at the campgrounds and having the campground sell them?
Well, she could do that too, but there's an entirely different implication there. Now you're asking someone to commit to inventory, right? So you're going to a campground with a totally different proposition saying, you know, we want you to commit to inventory. We want you to commit to a sales effort behind this thing. That's not to say that she couldn't have done that. But the idea being, if I can alleviate that whole supply chain and simply say, look, if somebody needs it, we can ship it. We can charge a premium, so that shipping cost can certainly be tagged on because this is somebody who desperately wants this product. In much the same way that Tesco could have taken a limited supply of grocery products and actually had them available at the Subway in Korea, they just decided to completely circumvent that entire supply chain issue entirely and go direct to consumer. And so I think it just raises questions for us about the creative ways that we can now take a product to market without necessarily needing distribution.
Yeah. So delivery services and things like BufferBox become more and more important, ability ways you can receive product.
Absolutely. And hence Google's acquisition of BufferBox and Amazon's experimentation with Amazon Dropboxes, for sure.
Yes. Interesting. I remember back in the late 90s in Toronto, there was a company that was trying to do something like that in the busiest subway stations, like the one at Union Station, where they were setting up a place where you could come and take delivery. But I think they were just too early. The concept is very similar to what we're starting to see now.
Yeah, timing is certainly everything. The other day, they were talking about this issue of distribution, and it kind of goes to, I guess, the whole notion of becoming predictive about where things are going. But somebody said, well, shipping is expensive, so you can't just assume that you can tack on the shipping cost to products and that that may not be necessarily viable. You know, consumers may not be willing to pay the shipping. But we also have to look at some of the things that are happening outside the industry in terms of where shipping could be going to. Things like certainly electric vehicles are going to bring down the cost for courier companies. It is potential within the next 10 years that we are going to, or perhaps 10 to 15 years, that we're going to see driverless vehicles. Take the driver now out of the equation for shipping companies. So the cost of shipping as we know it could actually come down dramatically as well, which could make these models even more viable than they are today.
Good point. One question that I had, you touched a little bit on people sort of falling into two camps, the creative ones and the data analysts. And we hear a lot about big data and the potential of big data for better understanding and targeting your consumers. How can small businesses work with big data? How can they afford it, or do they even need to?
Yeah, I mean, the irony is that what big data is attempting to do is what most small retailers do intuitively.
Yeah.
It really is. It's trying to overlay onto enormous organizations the same level of intimacy with consumer data that a small merchant might have. So knowing that particular consumer typically comes in on Wednesdays, or knowing how somebody likes their order prepared or how they typically pay for something. But the promise of big data is really also not just all that structured stuff, that when transactions happen and how they happen and who buys what and how much. It's also the idea that you're going to be able to pull together unstructured data and correlate that somehow to the structured stuff. So, for example, you know, you can start to understand that potentially when the weather is a certain way, you start to understand the direct impact on certain sales of certain SKUs and which customers tend to shop on those days as opposed to others. So, you know, you can start to draw correlations between what gets liked on Facebook and what actually gets purchased in the store. So some of these more random correlations. The nice thing about big data is that many of these interfaces are scalable. You know, it's not necessarily something that you have to say, well, this is an enterprise level effort. It's a program, right? It's merely a program that you are connecting your systems with. So The main thing for smaller retailers, the question that they need to be asking now is, what am I collecting and how accurate is that?
Right.
And as long as you are collecting robust levels of data from not only consumers but from other sources, and as long as that data has a good degree of accuracy, there are programs out there that can allow you to connect.
A lot of the small retailers that are out there, it sounds like they basically can really only survive based on convenience, most of them.
It may just be the opposite. I would say that it's going to be very, very difficult for the small to medium-sized independent retailer out there to corner the market on convenience. When, and I'll give you an example, if you go to a Best Buy store right now and you walk into that store, I bet you probably see in their TV department, maybe I'll give them the benefit of the doubt and I'll say 200 items that relate to television sets.
Yep.
If I go to Walmart.com right now and I do a search of televisions, it'll come up with 15,000 entries.
Okay.
Amazon, it gives me 500,000 results. And Amazon is now promising that within a short period of time, they'll be able to have most of their products to us in a day. So from a convenience standpoint, I think it's very, very difficult for any small retailer to compete with that. It's also going to be very difficult for them to compete on the basis of price,
yeah,
unless they want to go out of business,
yeah,
a way that they can compete with some of these Goliaths. So what does that leave? It leaves two things, really. Unique product. And when I say unique, I mean difficult to find anywhere else.
Okay.
Or of such quality that it's difficult to replicate, you know, somewhere else. So there has to be something that is distinct and unique about their product, and or there has to be something that is absolutely remarkable about their store experience.
Mm-hmm.
And not just good. You know, not just where we give better service than Walmart. Well, I mean, what does that really say?
Yeah.
That's an admission of failure in itself. So, I mean, it has to be so outstanding that consumers are literally shaking their heads when they come out. They can't fathom the experience that they just had. It was unique. It was remarkable. It was enjoyable. It was something they want to go and run right away and tell somebody about. It was that good. So those, I think, are the competitive frontiers for the small and medium-sized retailers. So, you know, it comes back again to that question. Nobody cares what you have to sell, really. Nobody really cares about your business unless you're doing something that no one else is doing, or you're doing it in a way that no one else is doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Then people will stand up and they will pay attention. They'll pay a premium to be part of that. You have to ask yourself as a small retailer, is my experience in my store good enough to charge admission for?
Ooh, interesting question. I like that.
You know, if everything in the store was free, but I just charged a gate fee, if I charged an admission fee, would consumers be willing to pay it? And if the answer to that is yes, then you're there. You've hit the mark. That takes an outstanding amount of creativity to try and build a proposition that is that good.
Yeah, interesting. I was thinking about that the other day. One of my clients, a woman who runs a store called Princess Florence Handbags and Accessories, and so she sells purses and scarves and jewelry, and an elderly woman came in with her two daughters who would be in their 50s probably, and it became apparent watching what was going on that the elderly woman has been diagnosed with cancer, and she was looking for hats to prepare for when her hair would fall out. And the owner of the store realized this and said, well, look what you can do with a scarf. And she started tying scarves around her own head, showing how you could make them look really cool and you could get all this variety. And the woman said, oh, well, gee, that looks kind of nice. I have a bunch of scarves at home. And so the retailer said, well, bring them here. Come into the store next time you have some time to kill or you're feeling a little low and want to be cheered up, and we'll play. Just bring them here and we'll play and figure out great things to do with them. And you could just see the transformation on her face and that of her adult daughters, who were just blown away. She's not saying, come and buy my scarves, though of course the woman is likely to end up buying more stuff there. She's saying, this is about making you feel great in a difficult time.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that is, it sort of sits at the core of this whole thing. You know, just maybe to finish off here, one of the co-founders of Netscape, if you remember back to the Netscape days,
yep,
he of course now is a serious venture capitalist in Silicon Valley and invested in things like Pinterest and a number of other social sites. He came out recently in an interview and he said, basically, retail is dead. I mean, that was a direct quote. Retail is dead. Everything, in his opinion, is going to be sold on the web. And that if you're a shopkeeper, you may as well turn out the lights and lock the doors because it's over. I mean, that is basically the tenor of what he said. And I wrote an article shortly after that. I reflected on that for a moment, and I said, well, first of all, you know, is he justified in saying that? And clearly, I mean, when you look at the numbers are dramatic and compelling. I mean, the way that online sales is growing and the velocity of that growth is daunting, you know. And now mobile is just fueling it. So there's some basis here for his comments. However, at the core of this whole thing, shopping is not purely about acquisition. If it was just about getting stuff, then sure, we would order online, right? Why else would celebrities brave the paparazzi if there wasn't something more to it? And I believe that I think it's very deep in us. I think it's an innate need of ours that is social. It's about getting out and getting into public and being a part of the horde, you know, and it's a social activity. So I think that retailers need to focus on that. Yes, it's about supply chain management. It's about sharp pricing. It's about, you know, product management and development and all that technical stuff. But people are coming to your store to satisfy a social need. And if you lose sight of that, I think you've really lost sight of the competitive advantage of a brick and mortar outlet.
Thank you so much for making this time. I really appreciate it. And I am certainly highly recommending your book because I really like the way you've thought this through. It's a very different approach and one that people really need to pay attention to. So thank you very much, Doug.
This was a long episode, so I'm not going to take any more time now to do a recap. If you want to see my notes on it, you can go to the webpage, frankonlinemarketing.com/show. And you can also, if you haven't already done so, take a look at some of the other episodes we've got there. I hope that you'll call or write or in some way give me some feedback on the show. I'd love to know what you think of it. In the meantime, have a wonderful week, and I'll talk to you next Friday. Bye.